Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to After Things.
We're so sorry. Justin couldn't be. Wait, what?
Wait, I'm Andrew Main. That's Brian Brushwood here. And then who is that on the video to our right?
Sorry to crash the party, boys. I know this is normally just a makeout sesh between you two goons, but I'm busting in.
Right on. No. So we were talking about, you mentioned during the show something you wanted to talk about in After Things. Do you remember what that was, Andrew?
Oh, you have the Elvis story.
Oh, yeah.
No, that was in the context of talking about, like, you know, we're able to do what we do because we have a wonderful group of people who are part of our community here who support us. And, you know, we're talking about the brand new DiamondClub.tv interface done by Sergeant Meffin. And, you know, and it's – and Brian will like, hey, can somebody fix this? And it's funny to me because, like, Brian will – I watched you like, oh, somebody go log into this and do that, you know, and somebody go do this and stuff. And how, you know, we're kind of living in an age of where, one, it's possible for people to collaborate with us and help us like this. And we're getting closer to that kind of future where, you know – like if depending on what room I'm in, I either ask for Siri or Alexa to like tell me the weather or whatever.
How are you liking Alexa? I guess that's the Echo is the object.
She says it's not the kind of thing she's capable of. So they have their strengths and their weaknesses. What I like about Alexa is just I don't have to say like, hey, Siri. I can just say Alexa and ask her to do something.
Yeah.
I would say that her intelligence is much more limited than probably Google or Siri in many respects. It's great for, you know, if I want to know the weather, if I want to know if I'm heading out the door, it's in, you know, right by my front door, I can ask, you know, what the weather's like. If I want to know, play music, it's great for that. I haven't been using her for a lot beyond that because – you know, how far is it from the Earth to the Moon? Excuse me. Alexa, how far is it from the Earth to the Moon? The moon's distance is 239,000 miles. So she gave me a factual answer on that. It's good.
That's Alexa, that's pretty fast, too.
Alexa, what's 1,000 divided by 3? She can't find the answer to that.
What? Right, got it.
Hold on. What's 1,000 divided by 3?
Checking my sources. It looks like the answer is approximately 333.333.
I cannot think of anything more Andrew Main than sitting in your laboratory of 3D printing machines talking to your two robot slaves and and quizzing them to figure out who's smarter than
the
other.
We like to call a 2015 three-way. Oh, yeah.
Listen, if I don't have two ladies vying for my attention, I'm doing something wrong. But it's interesting. I mean, I look at it where I look, how do I use it? You know, and for me, like Alexa can also like tie into like the Fire TV and the other stuff, which you can have like display stuff there, which is kind of a neat idea. I am super excited about, we have the Apple Watch coming out in 5 days. You'll be able to pre-order and then we'll have them in what, 9 days, it'll be there. The reason, let me explain why I'm excited about this. I've been listening to the book Becoming Steve Jobs and I'm really loving the book, by the way. Really, really, it's a very, 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 and having read every biography I ever could have before, I read biographies about him in the 1990s and stuff. I think it's a really good overview and it talks about what was different about him. How did the guy who got kicked out of Apple become the guy that helped Apple become the largest and most powerful, or, you know, one of the richest companies in the world? What happened? It wasn't the same guy. Things changed. And he goes a lot into the experience at Pixar and learning from Ed Catmull, who's sort of one of the unsung people in the business world, who's considered one of the greatest business leaders there ever was, who's a doctor, you know, PhD in you know, computer science, who had to learn how to become this person, and how Steve Jobs learned from him and other things. But anyhow, I get to the point where they talk about the different eras of technology, how we had the PC, And then it really became about small business and then bigger business of, you know, the PC becoming something for enterprise. And then the internet came along, and then computers became off the internet, and that gave way to things like mobile and then how the computing changed. And now with the introduction of wearables and all the attention that can be thrown onto the Apple Watch is the idea that how do you take everything that's in your watch and how do you take all these things like Alexa or Siri or Google and all that? How do you use all this artificial intelligence and smartness to get you to do the things we do in the world right now through such a tiny interface via voice or just very simple, have it know what we want? And that's – it's going to be a big thing. And I don't know if it's going to be the Apple Watch that's the thing or Android Wear or whatever, but it's all about, you know, touch – you know, touchscreen interfaces were about taking all the complexity of computers, like keyboards and mice and all that, and saying, make the app as simple as possible, reduce it to that, press this, do this, simplify the way you approach it. And it gave way to all sorts of interesting applications. Now, as we funnel all of that into one small little interface, things have to get smart, like Star Trek, like computers. They have to have an idea of what the hell we're talking about or what situation.
How long until we start to see... And I'm sure there's some kind of experimental stuff already out there for it. But how long until we see on a practical level sub-vocalization as a method of data entry, where it's like you basically mouthing the words and maybe just barely exhaling while you do so, but not engaging your vocal cords in order to write stuff down?
You mean like Himalayan throat singing?
No. In fact, the reverse. Like Himalayan throat singing is
wrong.
Is double vocalization.
And just enters in all of my thoughts perfectly.
You know, I think interface questions are interesting. And interface questions, you know, they're the ones that we think of the most. If you go back and you watch ever seen the mother of all demos? The back 1968 when Douglas Engelbart displayed.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I just listened to a... I think it was a 99% Invisible about that.
So 1968, Douglas Engelbart did this really cool tech demo. It's called the mother of all demos now, where he displays the future of computers. This is 1968. He uses a mouse. He uses a keyboard. There's window type things are sort of like showing how information can be organized differently. And he also has off to the side a 5-key keyboard called a cording keyboard, which allows you to use a different combination of keys to connect. And that's the thing we forget about. We saw the mouse, we saw the keyboard, and there was this other device because they were thinking like, this is this other way to input and whatever. And it turns out a keyboard and a mouse is really, really good. You know, there have been multiple attempts to try to introduce that other thing, but as machines have become more intelligent, you know, we haven't really needed them as graphical interfaces have become much more as we've had the spare processing power to do that. So when you ask me about like sub-vocalization stuff like I don't know. And I think that the thing that kind of excites me right now are the questions about how do we make these things smart enough to know what we're going to want and simplify our the things that we, you know, are going to ask for. And you see that, you watch the Apple Watch demos where you get a text message from, you know, Brian says, hey, you know, what time are we going to do the podcast, you know? And it's smart enough to be able to say, oh, he's asking a time, you know, and I can respond now, later, whatever, you know, do you want to get Chinese or Italian? And it can tell you, it can say, do you say Italian or do you say Chinese? These things, the ability of these intelligent assistants to parse this information and to simplify our options, that's what's kind of, that's really excited right now. As far as sub vocalization and other ways of input, I don't know.
By the way, breaking news.
Craziest thing about that demo is it was on Periscope.
That's back in 1964. They were sitting on it for a long time. We were talking about the David Lynch Twin Peaks on Showtime, and apparently there's like an official announcement saying that Showtime did not pull the plug on Twin Peaks. After 1 year and 4 months of negotiations, I left because not enough money was offered to do the script the way I felt it needed to be done. So I guess in that regard, I think your prediction stands that somebody else can come along and offer the right amounts in order to get him to do it.
Well, I mean, at this then it's basically David Lynch had an argument about the budget, and David Lynch said, I'm not doing this unless I get the budget that I want. And so now Showtime would have to cancel Twin Peaks for Twin Peaks to do something with David Lynch. However, I think David Lynch's idea is like, well, you can't do Twin Peaks without me. Everybody will think it's crap. Right. So good luck.
Yeah. Interesting.
Hey, wait. We never got the Elvis story. You got to tell the Elvis story.
So, as a comedian, I know, he was telling the story about, we're talking about when you start to live in a world where people kind of can meet every whim, everything you want.
Yeah.
He talks about how he was, in a suite in Las Vegas. He got to talk to Elvis. He's like, you know, his kids, he's a young comedian way back then. He's in the suite with Elvis, and Elvis is sitting there, and everybody's around him, and Elvis has got his gold revolver on his waist. He's like, "Hey, Elvis, why do you have a gold-plated gun?" And Elvis was like, "Oh, well, you know, I just got off stage. You know, I forgot to take it off my costume. I forgot to take it off." He's like, "Oh, well, why do you have a gun on stage?" And Elvis is like, "Well, you know, you never know when karate is not enough." "Well, what do you mean? Like, someone could be attacking me. It's like in the karate, but the karate's not enough. I have a gun." He's like, and this guy says, "What if there's, you know, a sniper in the balcony?" Elvis is like, "Oh, I've thought about that. I don't know." And Elvis starts to get a little concerned about this. And two people grab this comedian. They grab him, yank him out of the room, and pull him in the other room and say, "Listen, we got to talk to you about how to play with Elvis. You can't ask Elvis those kinds of questions. If you want to play with Elvis, then you've got to, you know, don't say stuff like that." And it was just because he lives in his own sort of bubble where he's not thinking about, you know, "Elvis, I'm going to carry a gun on stage." "That's a great idea, Elvis. That's great. That's you know, you never know who's going to come and try to attack you." Like, "Yeah, no, you're absolutely right." This was like, you know, Elvis was having all these top karate experts there, and he would like, he would fight with them, you know, and they'd be like, "Oh, Elvis, you got me. Oh, man, that kick was good. Oh, that kick to my knee was, yeah, oh, that was bad." You know, Elvis would pull out this big wad of bills, grab a few and hand them like, "Here, sorry about that. Here you go. Thank you very much." These guys would go out in the hallway, and some of the karate guy and Elvis were like, "Oh, sorry about that." He'd pay him off, and they'd be in the hallway comparing how much money. Like, "Oh, you made $2,000? I only made $3,000. Or you made $4,000? Whatever. I'm going back in there." You know, like, "Oh, Elvis, my ribs. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know how hard I was going to kick there. Here you go."
So great. How to play with Elvis.
How to play with Elvis. Which, and that is a you know, you can find yourself in situations like that, like in entertainment, where all of a sudden people are catering to you, you know, where, you know, you're on a set and all of a sudden there's an umbrella over you and somebody's handing you a soda and you're like, "Yeah, I can get used to this." And it's like, well, that's not a normal person. You know, normal people don't have other people catering to them like that. There's a point at which, you know, get your own damn soda. You know, there's a point at which you have to sort of, you know, not try to relish in the idea that you have people subservient or whatever to you. That's not a healthy thing, in my opinion.
Agreed. Hey, speaking of healthy, last week, you remember I announced my crazy vegetable eating shenanigan. I logged every single calorie all day long. I ate primarily spinach, kale, broccoli, carrots, celery, and then like.
Wait, hold on, wait. Give me a refresher on this, since I wasn't here.
Oh, I just realized, like, after you know, I had been on a pretty good health kick for a good 45 days or so, you know, and then South by Southwest happened. And it was this constant parade of entertaining people and going out and just, you know, shoving barbecue and beer in my face. And then I looked back. I was like, "Well, crap, I'm back to where I was." And then some. And then it turns out I'm going on vacation to sunny Las Vegas. And I realized I only had 2 weeks to do something about my weight. And so I wanted to try something a little more extreme. So I just did. I've just been eating all vegetables, and it's like a copious volume of it. It's pounds and pounds of it. And I told myself I could go to 1200, 1250 calories. And but the first 4 days I didn't. I would barely crack 1,000 because I was just full and didn't want to eat anymore. And so like, you know, no booze, no nothing. And then last night, I guess today we had Easter dinner with all the family and stuff. So after 7 days of it, I lost 3 pounds and have continued to work out a lot. So if I get half these results, I'll have lost 5 pounds by the time I take that little vacation and hopefully look a lot better.
Can I tell you a crazy, weird thing, which I want to throw to here?
Sure.
I was in Las Vegas earlier this week and ate a lot. Not a lot, but I ate a lot, drank a lot, so scared of being dehydrated. I got back here. I weighed myself. I weighed like 197.
Is that right? That's up. I assume.
I would say, yeah, that's high. That's like the highest I've weighed in like forever, right?
Because you're a taller guy than me, right? I'm only 5'6" and a half. You're what?
Yeah, that's way outside my kind of like, you know, I like to be like under 190, you know. If I've been working out, if I'm not been working out, I need to be like 180. So anyhow, weigh like 197, right? I'm like, wow, like I'm feeling like the most gluttonous. Like I'm like, all right, this is bad. I'm a horrible person. I've got it out of control, whatever, you know. So I watch when I eat. I go for a couple walks, whatever, like that. And, you know, I take a longer walks at night, like double my walking. I try to walk like 5 miles a day, whatever, like that. 3 days later, 187.
What? God, that's amazing. I'm so jealous of all you tall people.
It had to be.
People.
I'm not, but there's no, I could not, there's, it's physically impossible.
It had to be all water weight or something, right?
It had to be. But I didn't feel dehydrated. I think I just, for some reason, the hot air, whatever, or salt, I was just so bloated with water or whatever, but it was fascinating to me because it was like, I'm like, oh man, because like I was like, I've been under 190. I was proud of myself for like staying under there or whatever. And then I'm like, oh, you know, 197. Like, oh, I've got a long road to catch there. Well, and like 3 days later, I'm like, what?
That's the funny part was as I started it, I was recording my weight both when I went to bed at night and when I got up in the morning. And I was at one my target weight, what I always want to be is 142. But to be honest, I'll be happy if I'm at 145. But I was up to like I went to bed Sunday night after we talked at 156 and then woke up at 154 and a half. And then that night I went to bed at 156 and then I woke up at 153 and a half. Then that night I went to bed at 156 and then woke up at 152 and a half. I mean, it's insane. So this morning I woke up at like 151 and a half. So it's like, I, you know, there's variability, but it's, I don't know, man, weight be weird.
Yeah. But I mean, like, yeah, I think a large part of what we lose is the respiration, is the carbon that we put off in breathing. I mean, there's that other process too, but, that was weird for me. I was just one of those things like, man, I was like, 10 pounds in like 3 days. And like, it was water, but it wasn't like I wasn't dehydrated at that period too. I think I was just so, you know, over. Yeah. So,
at any rate, I guess today's the day off because we had the family over. But then I'm back to it for the rest of this week and I'll report next week how it actually worked out.
Yeah. This weekend has been a startling reason, on why I should be getting married. And I'm happy that I am because I've done, Ashley's out of town for the American Atheist Conference in Memphis and literally just sat around and like just ate.
And plus you eat healthy, right? Because she does everything vegan for you.
I mean, yes and no, because like I'm out of town so much, so I'm just eating garbage constantly. And then like she cooks really, really good vegan food, which is very often not exactly health food. You know, like it is – has just different ways to get salt and fat, you know, or fat like tastes, which are very often just as bad, if not worse, for you than other stuff. But even then, like, there's at least an element of like moderation or restraint, or like, hey, we should go and do something, or like, hey, we have something to do. Not this weekend, man. This weekend was just banging out Black Rock Mountain and watching Better Call Saul and watching the Scientology documentary. My big excursion today was to go walk down to go get coffee and a breakfast sandwich.
That's amazing.
And it was a big deal.
Do you want to get in shape? Are you motivated or is it just sort of like
along with learning to speak
Spanish?
You know, it's well, like the mind is there. I don't know how willing the body is. I want to not look like the fattest I ever have on my wedding day. That'd be a nice.
Are you at the high end of the scale right now?
I haven't weighed myself, but I feel fatter than I normally am. So I would like to do it. It's, you know, and you know, it's sometimes. When you match
you know,
up,
fatty. Come on.
Schedule.
Hey.
Like, you know, there's always going to be a reason when you can pawn it off on schedule irregularity. You know, it's so much of getting in shape is managing calories, eating a lot of the same stuff every day, sticking to a schedule, and building your kind of your existence around that and your productivity around those kind of highs and lows. When you have an irregular schedule, it's harder to do that. But even then, that's an excuse. I mean, like, there are people that have had my job that have run ultra marathons. So it's like, there really is no excuse, you know.
And that's the bomb. Like, I never allow myself to blame my schedule. I never, because, yeah, you know, and whether it comes to writing or anything else like that, because it is, there are people like, yeah, you know, there are single moms with five kids who are finding the time to get up a half an hour early to go do stuff. There are people out there who are managing their time a hell of a lot better. Bad time management, you know, can certainly be an explanation. But yeah,
I'll tell you what, like, the schedule thing, though, and I agree as far as productivity and getting done stuff that you've promised yourself you're going to do. But I know for me, I have, because I talked about, you know, part of one of my demons is, you know, drinking beer to help me go to sleep at night. And I was really worried about the whole insomnia thing. But because I've been at home, because I haven't had shows on the road, I've been able to have a regular sleep schedule where it's like, I haven't read a book in 3-4 years, probably. But now it's like, I'm doing the whole stepping away from all computer screens an hour before I plan to fall asleep. Getting in bed, turning on low light, and opening up a book and reading. And the rules are, it's like, hey, bro, you know, I have a whole psych myself up conversation where it's like, you can read as long as you want. You can read till 3 a.m. and that's fine. And then, and instead, you know, like 4 pages in, I'm like, I'm tired, and then falling asleep. I've had some of the best, sleep in years. But it's only because I have this regular schedule right now. It's like, that's going to go out the window once I'm hopping on a plane, going to different time zones.
Yeah. I actually haven't had a Diet Coke since Friday morning.
What?
I did have a little bit of, my little, Arnold Palmer today.
That's caffeinated.
But, yeah. It's not really just so much a caffeine avoidance version, but I've had chocolate too with caffeine in it. So I'm like, it was just more like, oh, so I like to go without a Diet Coke or slamming something like that. I had this, like, I've just been with every meal, just nothing but water, just a curious sort of thing. Like, I don't plan to give it up, but I just want to, like, oh, how long can I go? And it, you know, it comes into that question of, like, you know, the skill we should all be trying to develop is free will. It is, we should all try to work on that and build that. And there's a lot of good literature now out there, which we've talked about before, about, you know, why it makes it hard, whatever. And it becomes, you know, we can have a culture of excuses. We can supply ourselves with all sorts of reasons of why we can't do something or why it didn't happen. And, you know, at the end of the day, I don't want my life to be an accomplishment of excuses of why I didn't do things. I want my life to be accomplishments and not things that just were handed to me, things that I worked for, and hard things are hard to work for. You know, I'll go in periods where I'll work out and then I'll stop working out because maybe I get sick or whatever and then I drift off. But then you have to own it. You really, really, really have to own it.
Well, and that whole idea of free will, of course, you know, is based on the idea of, like, I want to choose things because I'm choosing them, not because I'm pressured into it because I'm hungry at this moment or tired at this moment or whatever. And it makes me think of, I forget which book I was reading it, but it talked about, of all the things you can do, the most valuable skill you can have in your life is being comfortable being uncomfortable. And I just Googled that phrase and it came up with, like, a whole bunch of stuff, like, you know, Navy SEALs, apparently that's their slogan or whatever. But it's like, if you can distance yourself from the moment and instead take yourself out, like, wow, this really sucks. I am nauseous and it's very hard work. And if you could pull yourself out of it, you can continue to do the thing that's making you uncomfortable, but do so from a position of, this is happening and I've got to get through this. It, in many ways, it's like, you know, when you get on stage and you could tell a bit's not hitting and it's not going well, but you're on rails for it, where it's like, you're able to kind of pull out. You're like, I'm really not connecting from this audience. What can I learn from this experience? You know, how can I make the most of this highly uncomfortable experience?
Yeah, I think that that's a key, is that so much of our problems, you know, come from, we just want to be animal. You know, we just sometimes surrender to the animal side, just the id, you know, just like, I'm going to have this, whatever. I feel bad. I'm going to do this. And, you know, Justin's talked a lot about the idea of shame spirals and stuff, but I, you know, I'm at that point where, you know, I acknowledge, you know, any reason I don't get something done is because I didn't get it done. You know, when I talk to my editors or publishers, whatever, I don't, I'll say this happened, but it's like, ultimately it's me, you know?
Yeah. The biggest thing that I've found that I think has been a healthy progression for me is when I feel bad about stuff, I try not to compound it, because I think that's where you can really do damage to yourself, is when you feel bad. Like, if I don't do things for 2 days in a row that I know I should do, it's always, I didn't do something today, not I haven't done something in the last 2 days, and also that one day last week, and also that one day 2 months ago, and also I haven't done as much as I wanted to do over the last year, because then you're dealing with a lot. Like, you've buried yourself so far underground that the idea of digging yourself out of it is a lot harder. And it's like, listen, I know I have gone through hyper productive times in my life. I know that it's never more than an hour away, you know, for me to begin, you know, being really, really productive. And it's just a matter of me getting on the right track to do it. And if anything, the biggest thing that I've had to figure out managing is how much is me not being productive, me not allowing myself any kind of like refractory period of like, okay, you put a lot of effort and now you got to take a rest. And you know, because my life in so much, and in many ways, it's been because I've been blessed to, you know, to be around amazingly high motor people that accomplish so much, that when you are around that, and not only working with Andrew, but working in newspapers and working, you know, with other people and many people at the Go Game, you know, you want to be, you know, at least competitive in the clubhouse of your little world, to be like, no, I do a lot. Like, I'm going 24/7, and I want to be the one who creates the most and creates the best and gets the most and the best out of me, because I'm looking at other people that I know and respect doing it, and I want them to know and respect that of me. And what I know internally for me has been the biggest struggle is like, well, you know what, you want to know what? Like, I feel like I have gotten a lot out of that, but if there's been a cost, it has been at ignoring my own limits on even just like, you know what, I could be more productive if I took a breather here and again, and if I felt comfortable taking a break and didn't think that it was me surrendering. And sometimes that can compound into stuff like, you know, in my lower moments where it's like, no, you want to know what, maybe I don't have to just get into these things where I sit down and refuse to do something internally, and I keep making excuses on why I don't want to do stuff. Maybe it's just, I just need, you want to know what? I need a weekend. I need a day. Mm-hmm. I need something where I can just refocus where I'm at, and I can assess what I've done, and I can look to make a conscious plan to do it better. And that's what I think I'm getting better at that, but it is a very, you know, it's a big work in progress for me.
It's when you understand the reflection point is what it is, and it's not an avoidance of it. I have a kid's book that I finished my first draft last week, and my plan was to get on it this week and start writing it. But I knew that was sort of unrealistic, because I knew that I needed to spend my time with my brain working upon other things, you know? And part of it is just trying to make sure that I can, you know, not overpromise, and that I can give like realistic expectations to other people, which is a big part of it, but it will get done. You know, I mean, I don't worry. And if I look at sort of the longer view of how much writing I do, like, oh man, I do a lot of writing. So I'm not worried about the output of that. And I'd much rather not be pushing myself and punishing myself with impossible deadlines and then spending months and months not doing anything. But it's trying to find your pace and find a way to find to do it. A thing that too, that struck me this week, I have a project that's had a lot of movement on it. I'm very excited, and we'll see what happens with that. And I realize that sometimes we put things out there in the universe, and we put them in the hands of other people, and maybe it's their responsibility, maybe it's their job, but we're so tired and so frustrated with having to push it for so long that we just want to put it in somebody else's hands. And then if it doesn't happen, we sort of just shrug it off. when
you're like, oh, well, I bought that scratch off and it didn't pay off. It came up, guy didn't do the thing.
Yeah, and I think that exactly. And I think that I knew when I wanted to get into television. I knew that when I decided, when I was at this very, very low point in my life where I did not know what was my path in the universe. Nobody came before me. The UFO did not appear. Nobody gave me a guidebook. Nobody told me, this is what you need to do. There are a lot of things I like to do. No one thing sung to me. And when I decided, like, okay, I want to do TV, I knew I had to make a decision that no matter what, when I woke up in the morning or afternoon, let's be honest, that my first priorities would be serving that goal, would be working towards that, would be like, this is my number one goal. The first things I do today, my priority today is getting that done. Everything else is secondary. And that was a big change for me. After I made that decision to do that, my life changed and things turned for the better. But then I think that, you know, as you know, we get older and we achieve certain things, it's very easy to drift from there. It's very easy to sort of drift off and then kind of go like, yeah, I want to do this. I checked all the boxes.
Where is it?
Yeah. And then, oh, well, okay, not my fault. And I think that's not the way to do it, you know?
Well, and so much of that, not only – I almost wonder sometimes how much of that attitude is us – and to go back to like the shaming like conversation that we were having during the regular podcast with the John Ronson book, how much of it is us deluding ourselves or us preparing to talk to other people about it? You know, how much is it us buying into a sellable narrative that we can go to other people so – you can say like, ah, well, you know, I did it. I tried. You know, it turns out it was out of my control. Oops.
You know, there's that. I think there's comfort zone. Like my first approach was like I wrote letters like, hey, I have this idea for a television show. And I wrote them, sent them to some production companies, sent them to a few different places. I did that. And then I just waited, you know, for the response. And the response was tepid at best. And I'm kind of like, well, I don't know what else to do. You know, I told them. And then I talked to somebody.
By the way, that temptation to just be all like, well, I tried. Like that exactly. Is so tempting. It's because it puts a button on it. It gives an end to it. It means you could go on to something else. And nobody loves to fail. It's like you get a big old bitter mouthful of fail. And then it's like the last thing you want to do is be like, well, how can I sign up for an even bigger mouthful of that stuff?
You know, and I did everything that I thought I needed to do. And then I talked to somebody who was a really successful businessman. And I said, what advice would you give me? And he said, you know, when I get an application, when somebody sends me a resume, I take it and I throw it away. If somebody shows up at my office, talks to my secretary and says, hey, I know I don't have an appointment, but if I could talk to them for 10 minutes, that'd be great. And I'm willing to wait. You know, the person who's willing to wait for an hour to go talk to me says, I will talk to that person. And that's the person I want to hire. And it was absolutely right, because that's the person you want selling your products. That's the person you want out there representing you, the person that will do that, go that far. If they can sell themselves, when you put money in front of his motivation, what will they do? But he told me that, like, you have to talk to people. You have to go out there. And so that was a big pivotal change. And the first thing I did is I went to the local PBS station, said, hey, I was just in the area. I wanted to talk to the guy who does development. I have some materials. Could I drop him off for them or whatever? If he's here, I'd love to talk to him. Guy came out, talked to me, loved it. Next thing you know, was back there for a meeting and they wanted to do a project with me. And it was just that I'm like, wow, it works. 6 months later, opened up my office at Universal Studios in Orlando to go talk to people who made stuff on a bigger scale, because I said, wow, if I just show up and talk to people, things change.
Yeah, that's exactly how my business partner on Scam Stuff, John Tilton, got the gig to schlep my stuff around, was that we probably got 30 to 50 applicants, people sending me resumes saying I want to help out, do X, Y, or Z. And meanwhile, he... being a fan of NSFW, used our own trick against us and organized all of his family to have like a positive Twitter bomb of reasons I should consider hiring John Tilton. And it's like, even though he was using a play out of my own playbook, I was like, this is a guy who at least knows my playbook and is not and is willing to rally and corral his friends to make that stuff happen. That was the heuristic that told me, you know, if he's the kind of guy who will do this, he's the kind of guy who can adjust, adapt, and listen and do the things that I need done. So that's why he got the job.
And that's, you know, I think that give up, as we talk about, give up on the narrative of why you should have succeeded. you know, give up on that. Forget it. Your goal isn't to explain at a party why you didn't succeed. Your goal is to be too busy to go to the party. You know, give up on that. And then if you can always do more, you can always do more. You know, if you write a book and the book's not selling, you can push the book. Maybe the thing you can do now is write a better book, you know. And if you're an actor and you're trying to get a part and you're having trouble with auditions, you know, create your work. You know, there are so many other options. If you got a product, you got a widget, maybe it's not a good widget, maybe it's better, whatever. I mean, it's just you can always do more. And I see so many people, all they want is an excuse. All they want is that. And it's just, you know, go to the excuse store, you know, go to Excuse Flicks, whatever, get a subscription, that's fine.
Dude, you're so right though. And it's like, and it's such a tempting life to lead, man. It's like, you want to be the guy who gets, because let's face it, it's way easier to like, oh, my job is to get this thing done. Well, the first step is to write an email to this guy and wait for him to write back. I wrote that email. I'm done. It's off my shoulders. I don't feel it. What am I supposed to force the guy to read my email and to comply? I've already done my part. I wrote the email.
Well, I had a meeting a couple months ago with one of my partners on a project, and we went into the meeting. The meeting was really good. Everything was said was right. And as soon as we walked out of the meeting, I said, "We need a plan B." And they're like, "Well, I don't know. Let's wait." So I said, "No. I want a plan B because I don't want to be waiting too long for this to happen because this is great. But if this doesn't happen," and I had a tentative plan B. I had sort of a way to go about it. Months drove, and we had a really positive response. Month goes by, another month goes by, and then 3 months go by, and I'm like, that's a quarter of a year.
I forget who it was, but there was some marketing guru who pointed out that that Napoleon had a reputation for being extremely fast thinking on the field, and that was not the case at all. He was not quick to deal with what happened. He just sat down and thought of every possible counter maneuver that he might encounter, every possible problem he might come up with. And he had pre-written plans for how to react to all those things. And as a result, he was always able to respond immediately to whatever was thrown at him.
Yeah, you know? I wasn't in a position to sort of pull because of just kind of the weird relationship thing going on with this other group. But finally, when it was like, oh no, they're not going to be able to pursue it. You know, first thing I do is I call my agent, like, now you need to do this, you know?
Right.
And boom, happens now, boom. You know, but it's one of those things that's like, I'm always like, when I was waiting to find out if I was going to get my TV series on A&E, I had a plan A and plan B. I had a plan, you know, plan A was not the TV series, by the way. You know, plan A was, you know, doubling down on the writing, all this other sort of stuff. And then it was, you know, B is like, okay, then I do this. But I'm always like, I will sell myself so much on the other plan too, to the point that like, I don't go through disappointment like other people do. I just don't. It just, cause it's like, well
it's all just data. It's not an indictment of your ability to handle things. It's just like, well, this is the current result.
But also that's learned, right? Mm-hmm. That's endurance. That's having been through. And that's where I think people hit the wall is like, once you understand how finicky and ephemeral and weird a lot of these situations in terms of collaborative power structures are. And I'm not just talking about show business or literature or performance. Like, I mean,
Nazi sex dungeons.
Not Nazi sex dungeons. The world. Like, your job and your progress at your job and your life and your goals are determined by many, 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 many different people. And the more you realize that this is not personal, this is not a judgment on your character, that's where the disappointment comes in, because you feel that it is you who is rubber stamped the failure and not the project and not the job you are doing right now. You know, there was a really interesting that I feel like came off as a little too bitter, but I think it's probably for the online traffic, but I think it was Lifehacker, one of the Gawker media properties, that talked about, you know, your employer is not your friend. Here are things that you need to remember, like with your job. And like, you know, some of the stuff I thought was a little like, it's like, you know, the HR department is not there for you. It is there to prevent lawsuits for the company. Like once you get a job is the only time that you should be doubling down looking for new jobs and stuff like that. And like, there was an element to that I think is important, that, you know, you always want to be looking out for, you know, and I don't want this to sound overly like, you know, you gotta look out for number one, bro. But like, you know, there's, nobody's going to do you the favors, you know, like if they do, it will be because they see mutual interest in you, or you have a benevolent element that kind of comes down, but that's found money.
That's the best way of looking at your job. Like, let's say you have a gig that you'd rather be doing, but right now you're working at a job, whether you like it or not. Maybe you like it a lot, but one of the best things you can think of is stop thinking of yourself as an employee of a company. Think of yourself as a self-employed corporation who is currently licensed its services to Dell Corporation or whatever. And as such, Dell is your client, and you want to keep your client happy, but you also want to make sure that your services get paid what they're due.
Yeah, I think it's nobody has your interests like you have your own interests. Nobody ever will. And if you think you do, if you trust some important part of it to them, you're often going to be met more often with calamity than elation. You have to understand that it's and then you can look out for other people. You can have friends and people like that you want to support and help do, but understand that, you know, Justin and Brian are two of my best friends in the world. They have their own damn lives too. You know, they have their own things they worry about when they go to sleep, their own situations they have to deal with and all that. And I'm fortunate to be able to have the time and opportunity to talk to them when I can, but end of the day, you know, we'd share kidneys with each other, not for fun, maybe, but the point is, but still, everybody has their own responsibilities. And the further removed you are from people, the more so. And, you know, it's there. I reference like in the Steve Jobs biography, the Becoming Steve Jobs, Johnny Ive talks about how like Steve Jobs will tell him like, oh, well, this is crap, or uses a different word, like this is this. And he says, no, he says, I like that. Because other people will tell you like, oh, this is great or whatever, but they're being insincere. And he says, and that can be worse because then you don't know. And you feel that, you know, I live in LA, we talk about in LA, it's like everybody loves everything. Everybody loves everything. I love it. You know, and I was talking about this with my agent. And he said, yeah, he said, I work for an agent that had a sign on his door that said, love me less, hire me more.
Yeah.
And, you know
well, and that is the disease of that town, man. Everybody is everybody's and best herpes. Friend. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, herpes and insincerity are the twin scourges. Hey, real quick recommendation, and it's something that a lot of people would probably not listen to because they're not sports people, but this is not a sports thing. The BS Report podcast hosted by Bill Simmons. Bill Simmons is a writer for ESPN that founded the Grantland Network. He is a free agent, or his contract is up at the end of this summer or during this summer. He will get a massive deal, either with Disney, which is most likely, or with literally any other partner that wants to bring him on, that will build him his own kingdom for which to play in. Because he has demonstrated a track record that he was able to build his own successful website. And he has a personality in and of itself that's important. He, on his BS Report podcast, labeled review for Furious 7. Because at the end of the podcast, he has his movie review guy to talk about that podcast. Says at the beginning he's going to do a 15-minute recap because it's the 20th anniversary of ESPN.com. The story of how he came to be at ESPN.com, which is really his kind of origin story. It goes 45 minutes, and it is certainly worth listening to, because this is a guy who has very much in, you know, is an internet success story of having the mountain come to Muhammad. You know, if you listen to him talk about, you know, the stuff that he wrote about and the stuff he liked and why he made the decisions that he did, he made the decision fairly early on that he wanted to be a national sports columnist, but wondered why national sports columnists were so rare, that regional sports columnists had such a hard time breaking through to a national level. And part of it was, in his opinion, in a regional sports column, if you're a Boston sports columnist, you can make jokes about, you know, the Charles River and you know, the Bruins history and the Patriots history and the Celtics history.
Scully, if, you know.
Yeah, like, or Mayor Menino. There's stuff that you can just get a reaction. And what he decided very early on was that pop culture, and specifically deep references to, like, the Karate Kid and Rocky and stuff like that, were going to be his local sports references. And it's
real quick. Like, what am I looking for? It's the BS Report podcast.
BS Report. And I believe the episode's called Wesley Morris Furious 7.
Wesley Morris is all it says on there.
Yeah. That's it then.
Okay. Got it. Yeah, so that's the most recent one, April 3rd. Wesley Morris. Yeah. Got it.
It's really interesting, especially considering it is all leading up to, like, really that is all intro to whatever happens to him this summer, because be it them spinning out Grantland to be even more of its own entity, or them, giving him more control or something like that, or him leaving, you know, he is going to get the kind of payday that you rarely see, for online, born online, media people. And it's going to be interesting.
I'll tell you what, it makes me think, this has been a rather extraordinary year. Like, it was around 1 year ago that I got word about hacking the system going forward. And it was a year ago that we launched Night Attack as an independent podcast. And, of course, Cord Killers was just starting. And, I, as you've heard me talk about before, I overdid it in 2014. And that's part of the reason I'm trying to keep a level head going into 2015. But it's amazing what happens if you people worry about making a bad deal to begin with, and it paralyzes them from making that first step. You could make a case for the fact that I brought Scam School to Revision 3 all those years ago and told them what I wanted to do, and then they fronted the money and they own it, and now it's part of the Discovery family or whatever, and I am just paid talent for it. You could say that was a very, very bad decision if, you know, when you're sitting from the outside. I would say that I learned all I needed to learn about how to communicate with audiences, how to tell stories on camera, how to build a brand, and here we are on the other side of 1 million subscribers. And regardless of what happens next, and by the way, I'm extremely happy right now with our relationship with Discovery. Everything is hunky freaking dory. Still don't own it, but that's fine. I'll never own it. But being on the other side of 1 million subscribers, is some of the most powerful leverage you could possibly have. Like, when I want to pitch a project to anyone, people take my phone call, because there's fewer than 1,500 channels on the planet that have passed this marker. And likewise, you and I did NSFW for a split take of $350 that we split between the two of us for 5 years, right? And we rearranged our schedules. We flipped stuff upside down. We treated it like it was the biggest deal in the world, making zero money. And nobody knew that we made zero money. But there came a time when all of a sudden we were able to do something truly extraordinary. We became one of Patreon's top contributing independent podcasts of all time instantly overnight, because we had built up that brand value. And I guess what I'm thinking about in general is that, and especially as what you said to the BS Report, you are building something, whether it's credit with your audience, whether it's a track record for success, whether it's experience in the field you want to be. I would say, don't be one of those people that insists on waiting for the perfect deal. Take the deal that lets you start as soon as possible.
I get this all the time out here, where I talk to people like, oh yeah, I think I'm going to do a podcast or a video thing. I'm like, oh cool. But yeah, you know, like if it's video, like, oh yeah, you know, I'm trying to get this friend who's camera and all this, we can use. I'm like, well, you're not going to get an audience until you do a lot of episodes. You're not going to get a lot of episodes unless it's something you can just do every week. Like, yeah, but I don't want to look like crap. Well, that's great. It's never going to get done. Good luck with your fantasy.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Oh, it's God. Like, say right now, I want it to look like crap at first. Here's the thing. And weirdly, this is the advice my mom gave me about dating. She says, go out with that girl. She won't be the one, but maybe her roommate is, you know, maybe she'll introduce you to the one, because that's how she connected with my dad.
That's a great point. And it drives me nuts because like,
I gave you other questionable sexual advice.
Hey man, save it for the album.
I know people I've been talking to for years are like, oh yeah, I'm going to do this thing. Why? Well, like I'm going to do a podcast. Like, do a podcast. Yeah, I got to get the right microphones. It's like, I don't want to sound like crap. You know what sounds like crap? Nothing. You got nothing. You have nothing out there. You can do good enough. And it's kind of like, I try not to talk about that stuff anymore. There's certain people I just sort of like, I'm going to write you off, you know, in these conversations because you want to talk about it. You don't want to do it. I'm like, no, I'm like, and it's just, they want that fantasy. And as long as they want that bubble, that just don't pop my bubble and tell me that I can't do it. And it's just like, drives me nuts. And it's just, oh God, it's the worst. And I know so many people who have that sort of like, well, I want it to be, it's great that you want it to be perfect. Congratulations. You have high expectations. Welcome to reality. Get something done. Get something done because you have nothing. I've had people I could put out for projects. I'm like, oh no, I have nothing to show you. They haven't done anything. They haven't delivered anything.
I'll tell you what. I had this shower thought the other day. So when we started iTrix and we decided, hey, you know what's going to be gigantic? RSS feeds and podcasts. And we were like half right. Like we decided to do, was it 5 weekly? It was
a Chris Angel podcast.
Penn and Teller Chris podcast. Angel, David Copperfield, David Blaine, and the Magic Week in Review. 5 podcasts weekly, right? And I was thinking about this the other day. I'm like, well,
meant Justin, you go do these podcasts.
I do. And it's like, if you could do it again, you know, like in a vacuum, like, well, you want to know what? Knowing what we know now, probably should have just done the one and then built excitement to see which one people wanted, which of the mini podcasts people wanted, and then kind of build it from there. Like if me now could go back and do it, that's what I would suggest to me then. But at the same time, it was like, oh my God, was that invaluable to me. You know, A, to just have every Friday be 4 hours of audio production and recording and scheduling and writing for advertisers and doing all of that and having it take up as much time as it did and having it be listened to with as few people as listened to it. Like that was, it was boot camp. Like it was ego boot camp of the highest order. And like, yeah, that strategy-wise, maybe that bore out to be not as good of a strategy as we could have done otherwise. But holy crap, did it make me so much better. And also just worth it to be like, you want to know what? If I do something now, I have a totally different mindset of listenership and what I get out of it and what my ego is satisfied on. Like, it's about the product. It's about what I'm happy with. And there's a process to it. But if no one listens to it, awesome. That's fine. And if you are doing something right now that nobody listens to and you feel bad about it, congratulations. That's how you know it's working.
Dude.
You are becoming better. Every second that you feel that, you are becoming stronger and better, and you are allowing yourself to do a better product.
And understand, the reason you're doing it is not for any practical short-term benefit. What you're doing is, it's like your brain or your perception is a muscle. You're building up the ability to see the world differently. Pre and post performing on the street, I saw magic performances totally differently. You know, it's like I would go to magic clubs or magic meetings or magic conventions, and I would see people on stage, and they would have their polished routines that they worked out, and it was always on stage. I was like, oh, what could I do that's on stage or whatever? Then I go to perform on the street. And when you're faced with the reality of here's your 2-foot strip of concrete, this is the passerbys that you need to grab, go for it. All of a sudden it changed everything. And it's like I stopped writing material that was visionary that I would imagine belonged on a performance art stage. And I started thinking, what can play in a community college hallway? And when you have that nuts and bolts concreteness to it, and likewise, same thing. It's like that was your street performing, doing those podcasts. You're like, what can I say that'll make people continue to listen?
Well, and also understanding those listenerships, small as they might be, were wildly different. You know, like the Magic Week in Review was by and large listened to older men, right? Like either because even for whatever reason it was popular more with probably dudes 20 to 50 than it was kids 25 and under, which are two pretty much of like the major Magic demos, right? People who kind of make it go past the teenage burning sensation of we need to do Magic, and then the hotbed of teenage kids who just get into Magic and then become obsessed with it. So we were more on the older end. With the Criss Angel podcast, holy crap. Now all of a sudden, I have a demo of girls, either it was like 10 to 16 and 30 to 50. You know, like it
wow.
was like these demos that like I don't talk to a lot to now, but it was I had to learn to figure out, oh my God, this is something that needs to be different. And now I am far better for it in the same way that like you learned how to perform on the street and you learn where I can play in a hallway. Flash forward to 4 years ago, you're getting paid a pretty penny to perform in a hallway at a casino in South Florida.
And I remember thinking like this is an obscene amount of money to be paid for an astonishingly bad gig. And meanwhile, it's like
you're welcome, Brian.
Yeah, dude. By the way, thank you, man. Let me give you a little pinky thank you. But it didn't intimidate me. It didn't scare me at all because it was familiar territory. Like if I was one of these prima donnas who had done a bunch of, you know, high end stuff, I would be all like, this is bullshit, you know, crap. What am I doing in this situation? I deserve to blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't. Instead, it was all smiles. It was like, it's going to be great. Don't worry about it. And it was great. I was the best hallway performing mother effer in the entire casino that night. You know, it's like, you draw on those experiences and you have to spend your time in the muck and you have to appreciate that that's what's making possible everything now.
You know, and there's, you know, there is this. I'm a person that I emphasize a lot on getting the information, but then there is the putting it out there and learning and getting there. You can have all the theories in the world about how to do a TV show or how to do something like that, but then you go on. You're on the set and you're on this, and you realize, oh wow, this is how things are made. This is how this is done. And I can sit there and like, oh, these are the perfect ideas. But I think that, you know, and it comes with sort of that mix. Like my, you know, one of the things that I try to. It gets frustrating because, like, I talk to people who, well, speaking of Magic, I know people who I want to be a magician like David Copperfield. I want to be as famous as that. And, you know, I've had this conversation with a couple different people. It's like, okay, right now he's going to go see this show, you know, live show. He's going to go watch this live entertainment. He's going to go watch these things. He's maybe going to go home and spend some time practicing, but he's not going to spend all of his time in front of his computer on YouTube with a deck of cards in his hand. He's going to actually go see the kinds of things, the venues he wants to fill. And I talked to a friend the other day where I mentioned I was just in Vegas, and I said, yeah, I almost went to go see Criss Angel's show. And he goes, yeah, I wouldn't see it. I'm like, well, why? He goes, like, well, I've seen it before. I'm like, yeah, but don't you want to know, like, you know, when I go to these shows, I talk to everybody around me. And I asked him, what shows have you seen since you're here? How did you find out about this show? I started trying to figure out, like, you know, what's their ages? What's the demographics? What's all the stuff? And anybody that wants to put – whether you want to put people in – if I'm trying to think about, like, showrooms and stuff like that, I want to know these things. If I'm on an airplane and somebody next to me is reading a book, how'd you find the book? Have you read other stuff by this person? I want to know these things. And people who want to know those things, I think, end up knowing more. And other people, they don't. They want to live in that bubble. You know,
well, and that's also that's covered in Dr. Richard Weissman's The Luck Factor. He talks about the difference. You know, they categorize the behaviors of quote unquote lucky people versus unlucky people. And a lucky people strike up conversations with random people in line, which once you open up those gates of communication, you open up the opportunity for a fortuitous coincidence that, that you know, leads you to a, you know, an audition for the perfect gig.
I watched the guy who I told you that he had the Elvis story. I was at a restaurant with him and a few other people, and there was some people who looked like maybe they came out of some sort of theater show or something like that. We're all paying there at the same time, paying at the checkout. We are at the diner. We go outside, and he's talking to these people like, "What's your show? What are you doing?" Da 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 da, and just engage them in a conversation. So I hung around and started talking to him, and I could see because he's got this Zelig like life of everybody he knows, so many people, and I could see how he's just. What do you do? Da 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 da. And I'm like, that's was very interesting, you know, thing for me to learn. I picked up something from David Copperfield, and it was the simplest little thing, but there was somebody I had a contact. He needed an answer to a question or something like that. And I said, well, yeah, I'll send him this person an email or whatever. And David said, why don't you call him? I'm like, well, you know, email's easier, whatever. Yeah, but just what happened to calling people? And in my mind, it's like, well, it's not as efficient. And I did have to spend a half an hour conversation with this person about how Houdini really did come back from the dead and all this sort of stuff. But I understood, man, that that person had – we had a half hour conversation. And so rather than three sentences, it was a half hour and probably, you know, it was a better use of my time to make the phone call. And
I'm like, wow, yeah, there was a dispute I was having with another magician about some content that I felt like belonged to me that was on a thing. And Taylor's advice was very similar. He said, pick up the phone, call him, you know, and Justin's advice doubled down on the same thing. He says, talk to him. You know, and Teller's advice was never threaten, you know, just speak on the phone. And it's amazing what opens up when you break down, you know, the structured barriers between people.
And this wasn't like I didn't need anything from here. I knew the person I was talking to, like I was going to be able to do them a favor and I was going to be able to help them out. But it was just the idea that, like, yeah, if so much of our relationships become just sentences, just lines of text, just 140 characters with people, then it's not the same, you know, and it's better to, when you can, try to call, and that's an effort I'm trying to make more. Just call people.
I mean, here's the thing about text. To me, it is an extraordinarily risky medium of communication.
Yep.
Because
sarcasm, winks, your emoticons only go so far to expressing your true meaning.
And also it's like, I know, like, Brian, you have a way of writing that I know because I've talked to you and I read it in your voice, but like you are every once in a while, and I do this a lot too, like capital letters, you know, like certain things to make emphasis because, and reading it in your voice as I know you speak and I know more of your intentions than the average person.
Sure.
It's understood. However, if it's the first time I'm getting an email from you,
like, who's shouting at me? What's going on?
Why are you yelling like every paragraph? Yeah. Like what? Like, are you scolding me? Are you acting like I don't understand what you're saying? And it's like, that is an overreaction. That is a misreading of it, and it is probably even leaving things cognitively out of these certain sentences to construct the narrative that makes you angrier than you might be. Right. However, you are always at risk in text. Yeah. You are always at risk of being misunderstood, misread, and put into a situation that – I mean, I remember one time – who was it? We were booking Turquoise Jeep for Dragon Con. And we were talking about stuff like that, and then it came to a point of the Jeep might – they were – debating whether or not they were going to do the show. And then there, at some point there was like a question on whether or not they'd send a few of the guys to our Dragon Con show or split it up because they had a possible college booking. And I totally misread who they were planning on sending. And I thought that they said that they weren't going to send Flint Flossie. So I drafted an entire email about, well, you know, we can book this or we can do that. And then I reread the email and I'm like, oh, no, wait, they didn't say it at all. It was like somebody else that they weren't going to send. And I'm like, wow, it is – I spent 2.5 hours
yes.
figuring out how we were going to do stuff and contingency plans and talking to other people for nothing, for just because I misread it in that one.
There's and I know we're running long, but, you know, CJ Johnson has a fantastic story where his cell phone rang. And he picked up the phone and it sounded like a call center at the time. And so his hackles are up and they're all like, hello, is this CJ Johnson Magic? And he's like, yes, what can I do for you? And he's like, well, I was calling you to talk about the police. And he's like, look, you know what you're doing is illegal. Like, what, talking to you about the police? You don't like cops? And he's like, no, you can't call me on my cell phone. Blah, 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 blah. And so he ends up running the thing off and, you know, gives this cold caller the what for. And then the next day gets an email from a friend who says, hey, so I recommended you for this benefit for the Fraternal Order of Police. Did the guy call you? And he was just like, he chased off what might have been a, you know, multiple $1,000 gig because he just, you know, in that moment assumed that it was somebody trying to sell him crap.
Lesson learned. They're going to ask him to do it for free. But
yeah, oh, yeah.
You know, we certainly, you know, we have to value our time and do that. But also the fact that the more that we do value our time and spending time to talk to people can be helpful. I've become like, I'm one of these people. I try to only make my phone calls when I'm in a car. I get wary because in magic, you have people who will call you up and try to keep you on the phone for hours. I'm like, oh, so what do you think? And it's you know, like,
I got this one guy. He calls me every time he goes to McDonald's.
Oh, for the audio listeners, that was just a work of art.
I love your phone calls, Andrew.
For the record, it's Daphne's California.
Oh, okay, I apologize. But what I like about it is the understanding of like either one of us can pull the plug at any time. Like, we can be in the middle of a philosophical discussion, and I'm like, diaper, gotta go. And you're like, bye. Well, click.
And I will say, did we lose Justin there?
Yeah, it says they're trying to get him. Here, I'll call him back here. There we go. His joy overrode his stream.
He says he's rebooting right now.
Oh, okay, got it.
My other response to that is, like, there are people I put into categories that'll go, hey, can I call you back in 15 minutes? That I go, well, I won't hear from them for a week.
Yeah, no, that's – no. And first of all, you are 100% – like, I really, truly take it as a flattering thing that I'm on your list of people to call when you have idle cycles. And luckily, these days, I'm much more in a position to take those calls, and I really value them.
You're immensely. In my car dash. You're in, like, I only have, like, 8 numbers there. And so, like it's like, but I'll call Brian. But I also, like, I know that usually with you, I know that, like, you're – usually we don't have very long conversations because usually with the kids and everything like that, you have to go from here to there or do something like that. It's like I call, like, oh, I'll call Brian because I know Brian will probably have 10 minutes to talk. And
correct,
then it'll
correct.
Be,
well, and also, like, if either one of us reaches the end of our window, it's like and it takes a while to get to that level of, you know, personal connection where you can say, like, anyway, this conversation is done. Bye. And know that there's no – you're not taxing the other person at all.
Like, yeah. Like, I have some friends, like, very – like, Chris Kenner, great buddy, right?
Yeah.
You know, our conversations are either 5 or 10 minutes or they're, like, 3 hours. You know, as one of us is, like, doing the drive from L.A. to Vegas or back and forth. It's that – it's that distribution.
Well, and it's that matter of maximizing your opportunity, because you never know. Like, you don't know what the other person's up to. You don't know. They may be begging for an interesting conversation to come in, but it's like the only way you're going to be there at the right time to have one of those deep philosophical 3-hour conversations is if you make a habit of reaching out to the other people.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a buddy, you know, I'll call. I'm like, oh, I know he'll probably be leaving work right now. I'm in my car, so I know I'll talk for 15 minutes, and then when he gets home. Son, like, I just – a bunch of little sequential ones are
– so fine. Carl says there should be an app for that. The problem with an app is that it would it's something people secretly want, but they don't know that they want. Kind of like TiVo. When I remember trying to explain TiVo to people when it came out, they're like, why would I want to watch more TV? And I'd have to explain,
what?
No, counterintuitively, you'll watch less TV. It'll only be the TV you want.
An app for what?
For what we were discussing, like knowing when someone else is in a position to talk or whatever. So it's like
called answering or not answering.
Well, but here's what I think will happen. You know, 5-10 years from now, as our Siris become Jarvises, our concierges will recognize that we're headed on a trip. They'll look at our schedule, say, well, he's going to be driving from now till now. You know, let me talk to other relevant contact AIs and say, hey, do you think it's worth, you know, mentioning to Brian that he should talk to Andrew? He's got a 3-hour thing. He was like, yeah, they haven't spoken for 4
I agree. No, I think that'll be Windows. But I also think, too, like, another reason why I'm very excited to see what happens with the Apple Watch is the idea of pushing a lot of that communication here where I can be like, the idea of sending voice, making voice text that much easier and simple to do, which, you know, every Google and every iPhone can do right now. But the idea of like, hey, Brian, I saw this funny interest, not leaving a voicemail, but like just blah, blah, blah. That's part of that long. I love the structure of SMS, that there's this long dialogue that takes place there.
Yeah. This persistent conversation that's on the record, you know, for good or for ill. I think it's probably for good. I think that right now, we are seeing the transition where our expectation is privacy at all times, and then there are times we go out and do things intentionally in public. I think that's going to flip in the next 10 years. But I think our expectation is everything is public, and that there will be precious moments that we press a button, and now we're in privacy.
But also think about the idea of me pressing the button and, hey, Brian, I just watched Daredevil. Play this once you've seen it. Stop here, but once you've seen it, listen to this and then tell me what you think. And being able to take what would be a phone conversation and stretch it out into sort of the text message sort of space.
Yeah.
Because then it could be like, oh, okay, I saw this, you're saying, but what about this? Because like we do that in voicemail. We don't really do that a lot in phone text because it just doesn't fit that medium so well. But when it gets moved to wearables or other things, that could be very interesting.
Yeah, Neshcon points out, isn't this what IAM and calendar apps want to be? Yes, but the problem is it requires that extra step for me to do a thing. And that's, I've never once changed my status on Skype ever. I've never done it because it's like, I'm just like, ew. But it's like once you enter in, you know, and it's not hard stuff. It's just tedious enough that I don't do it. And once you have a Jarvis and it knows, you know, it knows that Brian's sitting down to do this. So it's like it'll change my phone and Skype and everything.
Yeah, at the age of intelligent assistance, man, that is it's what we're upon right now. It's going to be exciting and terrifying in that. And it's going to be it's going to have both good and bad implications for how we interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it, like anything, it magnifies.
Yeah, that's right on. Well, crap, I guess we're going to wrap up with Justin still off the air.
What a quitter.
He went down in a flaming ball of laughter.
Yeah.
I do recommend if you don't want to watch the entire, you know, hour and 40 minute tech demo, definitely listen to the 99% Invisible episode.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot to sit through and do yeah. Just log through that thing, but it's fascinating to see just when you look at the time and place that took place.
Hey man, how's it been, Andrew?
After.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.